Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and we call him America's philosopher. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. Also, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer, his most recent edition. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure.
Great. I thought today we'd do a focus on what's happening in terms of financial repression, the policies, the risks, especially now given what has happened as a result of COVID and the result of that in terms of an economic recession or even depression now, and an accelerating burden of government debt, you know, to deal with what's happened to the economy. All of that has put financial repression into overdrive and accelerated it to a very intensifying level. So, yeah, just start with around of that for all of the risks. Your initial thoughts?
Well, it's a great topic, Richard, because the spectrum of policy accelerations, as you say, for financial repression is very broad. Like we've seen the Fed buying mortgage-backed securities in size, junk bonds, corporate bonds, as well as treasuries, of course. And so all of these have implications, right, for the financial system and for the real world economy. So, you know, where do you want to start, like on those ramifications or consequences?
Yeah, there's a lot to cover. I mean, we can first identify what the traditional definition and understanding of financial repression is, and that is basically the direction or the funneling of private assets to government securities to finance government debt, and also what the central banks have been doing for many years now in terms of repressing interest rates artificially, right? We all know they're keeping interest rates low. At different parts of the yield curve. This could be at the low end of the yield curve, you know, for short-term interest rates, but also in buying asset, you know, asset purchase programs, quantitative easing that targets the long end of the yield curve. And it could be in different assets, government securities or mortgage-backed securities. All of this is intended to direct those assets, you know, from the private sector to mostly government sector, different parts of the economy. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, Richard, I think we can, many of our listeners are aware of the sort of scale here, but let's go back real quick and say before the global financial, you know, meltdown in 2008, 2009, the Fed balance sheet was about $800 billion, you know, less than $1 trillion. And their response, their policy response to the global financial crisis was to leapfrog that their balance sheet up to almost $4 trillion, right? They basically created $3 trillion out of thin air and used it to buy mortgages, which, of course, immediately lowered the interest rates on mortgages because there was a buyer of last resort. In other words, you didn't have to worry about whether the borrower would default or anything. You knew that you could package the mortgage and the Fed would buy it, you know, sight unseen, no questions asked. And so, that And then they also bought treasuries, right, to suppress the yield and the interest rate on that. And so that was fairly stable around 3.8 trillion to 4 trillion, 4.2 trillion for quite a while. And then with the lockdowns and the COVID pandemic globally, now the Fed printed about another 3 trillion or so, and it's now balance sheet is about 7 trillion. And I think policy-wise, the Fed, the lesson as we've sort of discerned by reading between the lines is the Fed concluded they acted too carefully or perhaps slowly in 2008. And so their policy response now was to front load their response, like do everything they were going to, that they used to do over like say 9 months, they were going to do it in 3 months, which is exactly what they did. And so, and then they've kind of kept their balance sheet stable around 7 trillion. And so, I think it's interesting that, to examine like, what are the consequences of this? And you can say, well, the short-term consequences that, they've supported markets and kind of bailed out the financial system in the sense that, to take one example, by buying mortgage-backed securities in size, they've actually suppressed the mortgage rate below 3%, which is amazing because by some measures, as we've discussed in the past, inflation is considerably higher than 2.75%. So you're basically saying that the mortgage mortgage is actually not even keeping up. It's not even zero. It's actually a negative rate already. And that's an extraordinary measure to support the real estate sector, right? And if you look at their junk bond and corporate bond purchases, what they've done it by being the buyer of last resort, they've created a market where zombie companies can go out and sell billions of dollars worth of low yield bonds because people feel that the Fed is basically creating a put on junk bonds, that they've lowered the risk of owning junk bonds and speculating in them. And so I think one of the issues that I think we should disturb people is how do these massive distortions play out in the real world economy of investors and fund managers deciding on how risky something is and what to do to chase yield. Because those are really, the Fed is actually, in a way, manipulating our psychology to get us to do what they want, not only buy treasuries for security, but chase yields in junk bonds and equities.
Yeah, certainly it's all resulting in negative yields, negative real yields. So meaning you have a nominal yield minus the inflation rate. Where the inflation rate is higher than the nominal yield. So that gives you a negative interest rate, a negative real yield. So that is intensifying globally. As we know in Europe, there's tons of government debt with negative interest rates, negative yields. And that's going all over the world. In fact, now actually in Japan probably has very little inflation and very little nominal rates. So they probably have higher real yields than other currencies in terms of, if you look at the currencies, Japanese yen versus US dollar, for example. And certainly it's also resulting in a loss of purchasing power, right? With it's not just the US Federal Reserve Central Bank, but globally all of this financial repression, money printing, quantitative easing, repression of interest rates is resulting in a loss of strength in currencies, loss of purchasing power. And it's also leading to rising, especially now with direct fiscal stimulus and money supply, money velocity picking up. Significantly, it's resulting in inflation and will result in rising inflation. And that is actually a risk for financial repression, the risk of inflation, because this is one way to deal with the burden of government debt, as we talked at the beginning, that if you have an inflation rate, say 4% to 8%, if you do the math over a period of 10 years, let's say, you may have the burden of that debt reduced by half. And we all know inflation is running fairly high in terms of rates that are not measured by government statistics. What, you know, while the government may have very accurately monitoring inflation statistics, it may not be appropriate. There are indexes such as the Chapwood Index, which indicate that inflation in most U.S. cities is running between 8% to 13% per year, much higher than government statistics. So it's already beyond the 4 to 8% target range. I mean, although the Fed had mentioned 2% target recently, but, you know, at least 2%. So we, you know, we have this inflation as a financial risk. Your thoughts?
Right. And it's interesting you mentioned Japan. And it's because Japan, of course, has pursued quantitative easing for roughly two decades, and they've ramped it up. In other words, doing more of what's failed, if you will, in a sort of desperate policy surge aiming for inflation, right? And they've never really succeeded in getting inflation, despite owning a tremendous percentage of their government bonds and other assets. So QE has failed in the Japanese economy. And of course, it's not just a monetary policy, right? You can look at the failings in the Japan's political system that benefits the construction industry. So, you know, a lot of their fiscal stimulus has been building bridges to nowhere because of the strength of the domestic construction industry's lobbying. And then, and you can look at their demographic, which is, you know, a rapidly rising elderly population where people spend less, and the social sort of decay that's led to these trends of young people having little interest in getting married and having children. So there's, of course, a host of social issues that arise when you pursue social quantitative easing and financial repression. You end up distorting your real economy, and that has social consequences as well as economic. So it's interesting that recently the Fed, some of the ex-Fed policymakers published a paper where they proposed that the Fed would issue zero coupon bonds to individual taxpayers and basically pay households directly without even going through the banking sector. So in other words, it sounds like they're saying the Fed would get a Venmo account and just start transferring cash to households via Venmo or some non-banking transfer mechanism. And so this suggests to me that the Fed is realizing that they're pushing on a string. In other words, that quantitative easing and financial repression is not, once you get to a certain level of extremity, it doesn't really result in the intended consequences. So we see like the banking sector in Europe struggling to survive because, you know, of negative yields and so on. So you push yields negative, then you basically undermine your private sector banking, right? And then you also distort what people think of as risk, and they start feeling that there's no risk in buying junk bonds and chasing stocks because the Fed has our backs. And I think now we're seeing that that kind of consequence of a blow off top here in U.S. equities. And frankly, I think the same can be said of the DAX and the indexes in around the world, in Europe particularly, look like they're in blow off top formations, you know, as a result of pushing on a string and pushing these financial repression policies to extremes where they start undermining the system instead of strengthening it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you speak of bonds, and it's not just the Fed or central banks. So we have this concept of regulations like the Basel Accord that is essentially forcing the buying of bonds as very low risk assets for covering for unexpected losses. So regulations like that will likely be enhanced to do forced buying of bonds by banks or the private sector. And related to that, I think there will likely be rules on the private sector at the individual level. If you think of the 401k plans in the U.S., RSP plans in Canada, very likely, in my opinion, to have rules that will be placed on those accounts in terms of, say, 50% of the assets must be in state or federal bonds, provincial government bonds or federal bonds, that type of thing. And that would also encourage massive, buying of bonds by the private sector, right, just to keep the whole debt burden going. So I think that's likely coming. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you're right, Richard. And I think from the point of view of policymakers, they're looking at that pool of retirement funds and looking at it more or less like a wolf might look at a unprotected herd of sheep, right? In other words, like, why don't we just go ahead and grab, $5 trillion of that $10 trillion pool that's just sitting there? What's interesting is how it's already, from various policy statements, we know how the PR will be presented. It will be presented for your own safety, for your own good, so you don't do something foolish like go buy Tesla stock with a PE of 1,000. We're protecting you by making you own, 50% in a bond that pays 1%, right? Mm-hmm. Ironically, there is something to that, right? But it's again, financial repression works hand in hand with centralization of authority, right? If you have a decentralized economy and a decentralized banking sector and a free market, then you can't really, you don't have the tools or the centralization needed to impose financial repression. And so I think you're absolutely right. As the need to keep the system from collapsing increases, then the policies will become ever more extreme. And so, as you say, why not, quote, protect, unquote, investors by forcing them to own safe government bonds, which, of course, will then keep yields low, because we basically forced, $5+ trillion into government bonds. But supports that. I'm not quite sure of the right word. I maybe not exploitation, but it certainly a negative impact on household savings that used to draw 5.25% as a regulated return on money and savings and loans, and now you're getting almost nothing, or you're getting a negative yield in terms of the real inflation. So it's sort of like telling households, well, now that your savings will then be locked into a negative yield and you won't have any choice. And that's really the downside of financial repression that we're talking about. We can easily use kind of academic or dry sounding terms, but it's actually a form of exploitation where it's robbing the yield of regular households and giving all the advantages to like financiers and corporations who can then sell junk bonds despite the fact that their corporation is technically insolvent. And so it's creating a lot of inequalities in the economy and in society. And I think that's where you look at Japan and you realize there's social consequences to inequality, stagnation, decay in the economy. You get a society that people give up, right? They just withdraw because they realize there's no way they can win.
Mm-hmm. And some might consider, well, maybe I go into cryptocurrencies, but I think there, in my opinion, I think there will be either heavy regulation, right, financial and banking regulation to ensure compliance with the cryptocurrencies, or they will not be allowed to coexist with government-based cryptocurrencies.
Right, right. And so, again, I think if we had to characterize what we're talking about, I would say we're talking about policy extremes becoming even more extreme, right? Mm-hmm. And as I've mentioned probably in previous programs, I'm kind of an informal student of the Roman Empire, because there's just so much material that we have still, letters and documents and so on for that that time period, where we don't have that kind of documentation for all empires, such as the Mayan Empire or the Aztec or the Inca or other empires that have vanished. But the Roman era, there's a lot of documentation. So we actually know what people were thinking and doing at that time. And you, it's just really striking when you start reading about the crisis of the third century. They call it the third century AD, when the Roman system started to get under pressure, and there was some invasions and pandemics and a bunch of challenges. Well, they did the same thing. They took their policies of taxation and so on, and they pushed them to extremes that basically broke their social contract, and it increased wealth and power inequality to extremes that also just caused people to break down and opt out, you know, join a monastery or flee to the countryside because the financial and legal repression was just so intense. And so when I see the same kind of parallel process going on right now, actually, you know, that when you ramp up financial repression to these extremes, you reach a point where it's actually no longer positive, even though it's presented as something positive. It's actually undermining the social contract, increasing wealth inequality, and making it harder and harder for average people to maintain their lifestyle.
Yeah, that's a great analogy with the Roman Empire. Yeah, basically got to the point where it was no longer feasible to hold houses in the city, so people just fled to the countryside. The property taxes just became too high relative to the value of the land, and that's exactly what we're seeing now. You know, with also higher property taxes coming, as well high use fees, police ticketing for generating revenue, and overall more government control over property rights.
Yeah, and let's take that example of the we've already spoken about it in previous programs, the urban exodus that we're now witnessing. And some people are saying, oh, it's just going to be a temporary thing, and that everyone's going to rush back to San Francisco and New York City and so on. But there's a lot of evidence that it could be, in fact, a tidal change, that it's not temporary, it's permanent, because the nature of work is changing permanently. And the cost structure is now, as you say, unaffordable. And again, we can tie that back to financial repression, because if you lower mortgages to, you know, the 3% range or 3.5%, that's essentially a negative rate already, then what happens is, of course, the property valuations rise commensurately, right? And so a house that was only worth $200,000 when mortgages were 9%, well, you drop that in half, it doubles in value, regardless of any other issue. And so the urban household is facing extraordinarily high housing costs, right? I mean, the millennial generation is facing, just right now, they're spending 45 to 60% of their income on rent. Right. And of course, if you buy a house, it's also in that same range. Right. And so financial repression has jacked up the value of urban housing to the point where it's unaffordable to the majority. But it's also made the household dependent on that asset as its core, store of wealth. And so that's left the household extraordinarily vulnerable to a collapse in real estate prices, which is exactly what's going to happen if the urban exodus actually gathers momentum and is not a short term, but is actually a long term trend that's going to accelerate. So these are the kinds of consequences that that occur when you push financial repression to extremes, you start having unintended consequences and perverse incentives. And so it's interesting that you bring up about leaving, overpriced and unaffordable cities for the countryside, because I've one of my readers told me that the YouTube channels aimed at young people finding a much lower cost lifestyle are extremely popular now in terms of getting a cheap trailer or renting a trailer on a friend's property or homesteading in an abandoned, barn or, basement or, there's a lot of housing in outside the urban zones that's been abandoned or decayed. And it's very cheap. And this is exactly what's happened in Japan as well, where there's a certain class of young people who've moved out of the expensive, crowded urban Japan and found like these beautiful old farmhouses that rent for like $400 a month. And if you have a digital lifestyle, you can make like literally a third of what you did in the city and have a much better lifestyle because things are so much cheaper in the countryside.
And you actually, just back to your Roman Empire analogy too, the city of Rome went from a population of around 1 million maximum to down to 15,000. So, as people left the cities and went to the countryside.
Right, exactly. And it's that kind of transition now, no one believes it's possible, but no one believed it in Rome either, that a decade or two in the future there were goats grazing in the forum where it was once crowded with wealth and power, and yes, it can happen. And so financial repression's role in this is consequential. It's like there's many other inputs, but once you distort risk and return and our ability to assess that in an open market, then people are making decisions on basically false data, right? They're being told there's no risk, but there is still risk because they've untethered the markets from reality.
Yeah, the markets too could be in for financial repression risk in terms of financial transaction taxes. There's a lot of talk about that for capital trading, when you do a buy, when you do a sell, each time levying a high, or at least a small, but over time, if you're doing a lot of trading, right, financial transaction taxes could be high.
Yeah, and actually, I think that would be a plus because it would really eliminate high frequency trading, especially if those high frequency traders were charged a fee just for putting a bid out for a hundredth of a second, whether the bid was accepted or not. Because of course, there's a lot of spoofing, and that's part of the high frequency trading system, is to spoof the bid and the ask, and then withdraw your bid and work that. And so that would actually be a positive for the economy, but it would of course be devastating for the stock market, which is riding high on these sorts of spoofs and manipulations. So it really wouldn't affect the average person who buys and holds or trades very infrequently. And along that same lines, we can also start speculating on how different countries and different even states or provinces can start influencing how financial repression goes. In other words, if California puts a tax on transactions by itself, it's large enough that it would then trigger compliance with the rest of the U.S. This is typically how this thing happens. And the European Union, it's very similar. If the EU puts on a transaction tax, that will spread through the world because the EU has such a dominant share of the global economy. So I guess my point is that a lot of these policies are sort of like dominoes. Once a major player goes for it, then everybody else is sort of forced to tag along. either because of regulatory pressures or just because they don't want to be left behind. And so there's a certain amount of disunity, you know, in the between all the players in the global economy, but that disunity could create more volatility, right? Because some players may pursue more financial repression, and others might realize it's been a failure and actually lighten up, and so there could be volatility where capital is trying to find the best home, and that landscape could be changing so rapidly that it's going to be very difficult to know where the lowest risk, highest yield trade is, because if it changes, if regulations change overnight, well, then you could be trapped somewhere.
Yeah, and speaking of California, we might want to also mention wealth taxes. You know, concerning what's happening in California, even retroactively, I hear. So this would be taxes based upon wealth, and it could be levied on a yearly basis. And this also could be driven by the perception that, you know, somehow the wealthy are responsible for all the problems. You know, there's a sort of anti-wealthy movement, if you will. This is really a lot, in large part, the result of these financial repression policies that we've been mentioning, whereby by repressing interest rates and doing QE, it's actually made it easier for the financial sector, those that are closest to the money, if you will, to benefit from, right, exacerbating wealth and income inequality. So, but the actual cause may be attributed to, you know, looked upon as being the wealthy, right, the wealthy class. So your thoughts on that? Just wondering, especially what's happening recently in California.
Yeah, no, it's a great topic, Richard, and you're absolutely right that it's very difficult for the average person to understand how the Fed and other central bank policies impact them and how they've distorted the economy to enrich the already super wealthy, right? That it wasn't necessarily that the super wealthy did something. It was like they were handed all these policies on a platter. Sort of false ideal that if we boost the wealth of corporations and the super wealthy, that some of this will trickle down and they'll hire more people and invest in the real economy. But of course, that's not what happened. It created perverse incentives. And so now the super wealthy are a target, and we're seeing really extreme policies such as, a 10-year look back wealth tax in California. Now that's not law, that was a proposal. But then you go, well, why stop at 10 years? Why not go back and say it's a tax to 1900? So you owe your grandfather's wealth tax too.
Yeah.
but just the absurdity of this, and never mind if it's legal or not. And in a related kind of California topic, it's basically impossible to evict a tenant for any reason. Now, of course, that's being attributed to the pandemic and the financial crisis resulting from that and so on. But a lot of people are looking beyond that, the pandemic, and realizing that contract law and financial contracts are now prone to retroactive renunciation, if you will, or being hollowed out to the point that investors should be wary. In other words, again, this assessment of risk. What's the risk in buying a commercial building if all your tenants are basically given carte blanche to not pay rent? I mean, the value of that building is effectively zero or negative because you still owe your property taxes and regulatory fees, and yet you're not able to enforce collecting the rent. So now that's a little bit off of our financial repression topic, but again, I think it's interesting to tie in financial repression and centralized policy, because the two are inextricably linked. You know, you cannot have financial repression without a heavy-handed centralized authority who can impose it. And once you give the authorities that kind of heavy-handed centralized power, well, then it's like you're opening the doors to all sorts of policy extremes. And that's where we're talking about the Roman model, where dozens of edicts were imposed, where it got so extreme, just to give you one crazy example, where it became so difficult for the tax collectors to get the taxes out of these impoverished people, that the tax collectors were retiring or quitting in droves. And so there were lots of edicts forcing the taxpayers to keep doing their job, that they were, they're threatened with death if you don't keep collecting taxes. Yeah. And so, I mean, this is crazy. And, yeah. But, and yet you can easily imagine how, what's going to happen when police forces retire or just quit en masse because they don't feel institutionally supported, or sheriff departments just start refusing to evict impoverished tenants. In other words, and so that's the kind of social breakdown you get with policy extremes, starting with financial repression. Mm.
So we always like to end on a positive note with some, ideas, positively how everybody can adapt or make best of this, or where to invest for protection. And so just thought, we'd do that type of discussion to end today. And I just want to mention also first on the idea of the, back to our discussion on moving to the suburbs or the, exosurbs, rural areas, countryside areas, what we mentioned before, which is actually probably one of the better solutions. Because the idea of going overseas, while it might be attractive, countries that have implemented financial repression, especially capital and exchange control programs, what happens is you eventually get to the point of exit taxes. So this would mean you would have to pay an actual fee on your wealth, right, as you leave the country, like say maybe 30% or something, and then you're allowed to leave. Some of the wealthy have already left, right, in many of the developed countries, right? They've gone to New Zealand, St. Kitts, St. Barts, all these places. That's already been happening. But, if that trend picks up significantly, I think we're likely to see capital controls, exchange controls. But so, the idea of moving to lower cost areas within the country, right, I think is one idea, one solution.
Yeah, absolutely. And seeking out like-minded people and communities with like a diverse economy. So in the same way that buying gold and silver is sort of an insurance policy against the collapse of fiat currencies, going to a place where there's actually, fresh water and maybe hydropower or other sources of energy, a diverse economy that includes agriculture, maybe a thriving micro manufacturing and a tech sector, maybe, however limited, that these are sort of magnets for social and financial and human capital. They're going to be more valuable because everybody values what they're going to have, which is like a little bit of a cultural nexus, a broad-based sort of diverse economy with niches for a lot of people and a very low cost of living. And so I could easily imagine that if somebody was really smart about this, they would buy a decrepit, a trailer park that's considered, poverty level or very low level of existence, and actually make it into something super attractive, and with some social activities and social capital, and that would become a magnet for people that are going to bring, you know, talent and their income and be part of that community. And it's I'm seeing sort of people already sort of informally pitching other people like, hey, I just bought a really nice trailer and I'm going to put it on my farm. And if you don't mind, you know, helping me with the labor, then you get to live here free. And so I think there's going to be a lot of informal things like that. And there may very well be opportunities for people to sort of be networking in that and facilitating that kind of connection between income sources and people looking for like a modest income and a really cheap place to live. So there could be a rural exurb renaissance, if you will, because as we know, at least in the U.S., but I think it's actually true in Europe for sure. I'm not sure about Canada, but the rural towns and countryside have suffered greatly. They've suffered a tremendous loss in human and social and economic capital leaving for these big cities. And so if that starts flowing back to these areas, it wouldn't take a lot to make a huge difference in the local economies on the upside.
And in terms of investments, I think because of the negative yields, I think investments in real assets make sense, precious metals, industrial metals, agriculture, farmland, real assets. Also online technology companies or delivery service type companies, considering the trends in the economy, and just the overall less assets as well in your 401k and RSP, due to the risks likely coming from changes in the rules on those accounts.
Yeah, absolutely. And while we cannot print money like a central bank, if you have skills and a market for your skills, that's a way of printing money if you think about it, because your skill, you can always trade that for real value. And so that's kind of like a way of printing money. So, you know, I think part of what we're talking about with a renaissance is in rural or exurbs is as that economy creates more opportunities for people to find a little niche to generate income, then that feeds on itself. And so there's going to be, I think that's where investment opportunities are going to arise in this. You might even call it a revolution in these rural economies that have been starved of capital, you know? And so there's, of course, whenever a place has been starved of capital, then the first capital in is going to gain the biggest returns, right? So that's my ending thought.
Yeah, and all of these themes are very synergistic and aligned with many of your writings and many of your books, right? Of what you see as like a decentralized economy, a movement to decentralization, more local community type economy. Your final words on that?
Yeah, exactly. That I think is where the growth is, because it's you've got to give people an authentic chance to get ahead. You can't just kind of BS them with negative yields and no way to get ahead. So I think that's what we're talking about is an authentic renaissance where there's authentic opportunities for talent and capital to earn a good return, because it's doing good in the local community.
Wow, great insight and discussion, Charles. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. There's samples of all my books and a lot of archives. And I'll try to provide a rant or two for those people who value that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Charles. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.